Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. Happy Holidays. I'm your host, Brett Williams. Today on the show, we have Jennifer Trowbridge, educator and guitarist. I have this from the vaults. She was here in the summer. We sat down and talked about the various things that she's involved with. She was part of the Manus Festival. I would love to go out there and get more interviews. I just don't have the time. Marco Sator was in town. He was like, can we meet Thursday? I had absolutely no time on Thursday. Can we meet Wednesday? I had no time on Wednesday. It's been very, I don't know what to do as far as keeping this show going. I'm doing it. I've just got to be better about it. I've got to find more time on the weekends to do it. I've got to interrupt whatever I'm doing and get this show out. It's important to me to keep on doing it. So I assure you that I'm going to continue doing this, even though this has been the longest I think I've gone without releasing an episode. Is it 3 weeks, four? I don't know. It's been a while. I'll get back on it. I'm missing it. I feel it. I feel like I'm not able to talk as freely as I was before. And that's because I haven't done it for a while. Anyway, the show is sponsored by NYCGuitarSchool.com. That's NYC as in New York City, GuitarSchool.com. You can go to New York City Guitar School. They have locations in Midtown, Upper East Side, Astoria, Brooklyn, and Westchester. And right now, you can go on there and you can get a gift. Why not give somebody the gift of a guitar lesson? Gift the guitar. It's the perfect gift for your special guitarist. You can design your own instant e-card or print it out and, whatever you want to do. You can gift a 10-week group class to someone you love or someone you like or someone you're trying to win over for political reasons. You can gift, just to get them a couple of private lessons. And you can also choose your own design. It says right here, choose from our library of holiday and rock and roll themes. Who doesn't love rock and roll themes? We're also sponsored by SavageClassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E Classical.com. You can go there and Richard Sage, his name is Sage, even though he is the owner and manager over there at SavageClassical.com. Richard Sage will hook you up with the guitar of your dreams. Go to SavageClassical.com today. How does that all sound? Also sponsored by BarkBox. That's BarkBoxTrial.com. I'm sorry, guys. Let me just check this out. 1 second. I don't remember. I think it's BarkBoxTrial.com/insider. BarkBoxTrial.com/insider. Go there and get your dog a holiday present. They won't know that it's the holidays. They have no sense of time, I don't think, with the exception of nighttime. I assume they're on some sort of clock. Like we are. I don't know anything about dogs. Let's look it up. No, let's not look it up. Let's stay focused, Brett. It's BarkBoxTrial.com/insider. What you do is you get a box. Inside the box is a group of objects for your dog. You get like a toy. I actually saw one. Oh my gosh. I saw one at one of my students' house. At Patty's house there. I went to Patty's house and she had a BarkBox and it was pretty cool. I don't know how expensive they are, but I know that you can get a 6-month deal or something. You know what? I should really know what I'm talking about, but I don't. Just go to BarkBoxTrial.com/insider and see what they give you. Okay. That's it for the reads today. I don't want to, I feel like I've been advertising a lot lately with the exception of the political episode last time. Thank you for those of you who wrote and said that I did a good thing. If you disagree with me, thank you for tuning in again. I appreciate it. You know, we're all on the same side here. We all like guitars. I think I do. I don't know. I don't feel like a guitarist right now. I had a tough week. I had, a foot problem. You know about my foot problem, right? Some of you have been listening to the show for a while. I had I don't want to say it. I don't want to say the name of it. It's just too shit embarrassing. It's gout. That's G-O-U-T, folks. G-O-U-T is what I have. I have gout. What do you think about that? Add that to my list of woes. God, I mean, you know, me and my girl were talking about it, and I think she said, I really wish they would come up with another name for what you have. Because it really sounds like some infection, you know, something awful, and it's associated with toes. It's just the whole thing. But actually, I think for a male, I have a relatively attractive feet. But I dealt with that, and then this is just a litany of issues. Okay, so I did that for a week, and then it got so painful. And this kind of a run that I've had with this thing, this hasn't happened for, you know, like a year and a half, 2 years. I haven't really experienced pain that's lasted more than an evening. But dude, okay. So I know some of you out there are already starting to scroll down all the different things I can do. I lost weight for it. I, you know, eat an apple or an orange every day because you're supposed to have vitamin C. I drink black coffee instead of put cream in it. I eat some vegetables, but you know, the fact of the matter is that I've been eating out a lot lately and, you know, I drink, I'm a drinker. And I shouldn't be, I guess I shouldn't be, but it's part of, I think I'm afraid to find out what I would be like if I didn't. I pride myself on being able to be social and stay out late and keep up. And the idea of taking that away from me would be just one more thing that I would have to do without. And I just don't want to do without it. You know, does that make sense to anybody? I know that people that don't drink think that people that drink are like the most irresponsible. Like, why? Why are you drinking? I don't know. Why do you sit at home all night, every night? And I don't know. I feel in a sense that it keeps me calm. I think that it reduces aging to some degree. I should not be reading reading copy for drinking today. Drinking is bad for you. I mean, it is. But, you know, I think that if I can go to bed at night and feel a little happy after a hard day, after a challenging day that's filled with some self-doubt and stuff like that, if I can just sort of go to bed feeling like a little bit like, hey, you know, I had some fun today. I had some fun at the end of my day. Maybe I went out and caught up with an old friend over a couple of drinks. Maybe I, played a video game. Maybe I, got to the next level of, intimate conversation with the person that I love. All these things, you know, this is something that I have just always done. It's not the primary cause of this thing. I don't even want to say the name of it anymore. Let's call it arthritis. It's not the primary cause of it, but like anything else, do you drink or do you smoke? And when you got to say yes to one of them or both of them, you have to go like, okay, well, I guess this is it. I mean, they want it. That's like the first thing that's supposed to go. And I think it's just easier for people who don't do it to just, the person that I work with, my boss, in a sense, the teacher that I work under, said the other day, one of the TAs, not me, had spilt coffee, on the PA system. So she was like, okay, that's it. No more coffee in the classrooms. And I was like, well, you know, that's easy for you to say. She doesn't drink coffee. You know, she doesn't drink coffee. So for her, the idea of not having coffee when you're teaching for 5 hours is no big deal. Like, what? Why would you need that? Well, because it's not a need. It's something that makes the job more pleasant. It's something that makes goals a little bit more easy. And I do have goals that involve drinking. I do. That's why I don't become a vegetarian. I've always wanted to be a vegetarian, but I don't become a vegetarian because I don't want to be a pain in the ass. I want to say yes. I want to say yes to life. And this is a big part of that. Big part of it is like, hey, we're all getting together. You want to come out? And I'm like, no. Or I show up and I'm there for like 40 minutes and I get bored because that's probably what it really is, isn't it? Why do I drink? Because I'm bored. Right? If I'm not bored, I'm not going to drink. I don't know. I don't know. I'm confused. I can't figure it out. I know that I've gone a couple of months without drinking, a couple of years ago, probably 10 years ago, I don't know. Something happened with my stomach. And I was like, the doctor said, don't drink. So I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm not drinking now. And it didn't really help. You don't think that's just a go-to for doctors? Do you drink? Yeah. No, you know, don't. Okay, doctor. Okay, doctor. Even if I was a doctor, I would drink. And it sucked. It sucked. I don't know how you guys do it. It's so boring. Everything is watching a baseball game is boring. I think I am this. You know what? I sound like an alcoholic. This is what they sound like, isn't it? Everything's boring. I love it. Anyway, so I got to figure that out. And I ended up having a panic attack on Friday, yesterday, as a result of these drugs that I have to take when I feel this pain. So I took one kind of drug, oxycodone. I don't know. It's the one drug that, I guess it's a drug that helps you out when you, it's like the drug from Breaking Bad they're always trying to get a hold of. To make the crystal out of, or whatever, the meth. I don't know. But so maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe it's the heroin one. Anyway, it's one that like they don't want to give you. But they gave it to me and I never touched it because I don't like prescription. I don't like drugs that much. So I take that at night, sort of stay up all night tripping a little bit on that, and then wake up still in pain, go into work with the kids in the Bronx. They are, I walk into work. Okay. I've got like no sleep. It was my brother's, you know, birthday party the night before. So we were out. I wake up, I go in the next day and I look at the, you know, we take a look at what we're doing. The unit is on bucket drumming. So it was 5 hours. I was just looking at the day. I walk in the door and I hear, bah, gah, 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 just the kids going bananas. The teacher's screaming at the top of his lungs, you know, sitting there going, stop it. You need to do the rhythm. You know, it was a unit on triplets. So it's like, da, 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 da. And he uses the Kodai method. You know what Kodai is? Kodai, they like spelt Kodalay, the composer. I didn't know that. But that's that taki, tika, tika, ta, tika, tika, ta, ti, ti, ta, ta, right? Where TTs are eighth notes and tika tikas are six. I never learned that way. I always learned the counting method. But anyway, so now I've got that method under my belt. And we're doing it was a method I'm trying to teach these kids triplets with buckets. And they don't understand what the hell's going on. Triplet. Triplets are always amazing to me because they are just like, it's like a completely different rhythmic universe. You know, it's a whole different thing. It's not, it does not belong to the family of the eighth note. You know, we all come from the quarter note, but you know what I'm saying? It's like this little, it's a whole different universe. It's always fascinated me. It's very, when you listen to it, the mathematic obscurities of what's going on do come into play. So I've always found that fascinating. Let me see if my roommate's home. Jason? Oh, sorry. I'm just doing the intro. I'm sorry. I'm going to be talking for like a little bit. I'm sorry, dude. I might sound like kind of a jackass too. Okay. Okay, thanks, dude. Anyway, so I walk in and we're doing bucket drumming. So I do that and at lunch, I go out and I decide that I'm going to take another pill, a different one. Indomethacin, I guess it's called. So I'm like, because I'm just like my head's throbbing as a result of the unit on bucket drum triplets. So I do that. I take that. And then I'm just like sitting there trying to take pictures of this is the most insane intro of all time. But this is just like Fear and Loathing in the Bronx. But what I do is I go and I try to take pictures of chickens for my girlfriend. And that's when it hits me. I'm just like sitting there and I kind of start kind of tripping out a little bit. Right. So I'm trying to take pictures of these wild chickens. There's like seven wild chickens. I'm just like following them around and start getting kind of dizzy, going like, oh, I'm just staring at a rooster for too long. Then I go back into the room and, you know, we're still doing bucket drumming. And then that's when it hits me and that's when I start freaking out. So I step out of the room for 5 minutes and then I go and I come back. And then I kind of do that periodically. I go back and forth, you know, between the music room and just there's this little room off to the side that you can go, you know, if you need to get out or if the teachers need to do their lesson plans. So I'm doing that. And then I start like literally having like a full blown panic attack for the first time in 5 years. So I've only had one before and it was in Central Park and, you know, it was just the same sort of thing, not sleeping, caffeine. But this, so I think just the combination of everything, the two drums, the two different drugs sort of dovetailing each other, the unit on bucket drumming that took place over the course of 5 hours that I was exposed to on no sleep, all these things hit me and I had to leave work. I had to leave work. I had to report to the principal. I was embarrassed, you know, cause they kind of think I'm a cool guy. And then I end up going there, like going like, hey, I don't know really where I am right now. I don't feel comfortable around the kids. I need to get out. So I end up getting out, getting into a cab cause I'm sort of afraid to get into the subway. You know what I mean? This is taking a turn, isn't it? Then I'm on 149th Street and St. Anne's. In the Bronx near a park, just trying to find my way. I'm on the phone with my girlfriend. She's like, just come over. I get in the cab. The guy turns around and is like, hey man, what are you doing? And he's trying to get me up. He wants me to take the Bruckner. I'm like, look, I just need you to get across, get me into Manhattan. He doesn't know what I'm talking about. I'm like, I need you to get me across this bridge. I know there's a bridge on 149th Street. I have to get out of the cab. And then I'm in like, you know, the South Bronx. Downtown South Bronx. So I'm just walking around. There's like, you know, record stores and video game stores blaring things and, you know, people screaming into megaphones like, all things must go. Everything must go. Prices are slashed. You, sir, just like, you know, yelling and, you know, passing out. Absolute nightmare. I finally get in a cab and I get to my girlfriend's house. And then she just like, you know, lays me down. It does a bunch of yoga. There's like yoga stuff everywhere. So I'm all yoga'd out and I fall asleep. And wake up, I'm in okay. But so that's that anyway. So that's my excuse for not getting anything out on time is that this has been what's going on. It's a combination of panic attacks, Thanksgiving, and gout. So I hope you guys can forgive me. And remember, we're sponsored by NYCGuitarSchool.com. That's our new sponsor, NYCGuitarSchool.com. You can go there and you can get a gift certificate and give somebody you love guitar lessons for the holidays. They have 10. What do they got? They got 10-week group lessons. They got private lessons. And you can design your own gift certificates there. Also, savageclassical.com and barkbox.com. Barkboxtrial.com/insider for a special discount on all things BarkBox. Okay, so thanks for joining me. And here's educator and guitarist Jennifer Trowbridge.
Well, actually, no, because you're saying you didn't grow up playing classic.
Right, I didn't. I grew up mainly playing jazz guitar.
Yeah.
My dad was a jazz drummer in the 50s when jazz was pop music.
That's right.
When you would go to a party and there would be a live jazz band playing and people danced to jazz.
Mm-hmm. I missed that thing, but I think most of us romantics are from that era.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Or we miss those days where there was romantic music mm-hmm. all around you,
mm-hmm.
not just this constant attitude music. But as far as like you know, starting musicology, what was the impetus to do that?
Well, I originally went to school deciding to be pre-med because mm-hmm. I was super interested in science, but I decided I wanted to study music academically, and that was the program that they had there.
Right.
I switched over from the science classes into the musicology classes, but I've always had an interest in science, and after I finished my bachelor's in music, I worked for 7 years in public health research.
Really?
Yeah.
And 7 years?
Mm-hmm. Full-time, I was running research studies and doing data collection and working for people in the fields of sociology and psychology. And then after that, that's when I went and pursued a performance degree at Northwestern. So I studied with Ann Waller at Northwestern and did a 2-year master's program. And at the conclusion of that, that's when I started my school of guitar in Chicago.
So you did just 2 years master's in performance, mm-hmm. in guitar performance. That seems like that'd be kind of hard to break into without like a bachelor degree, but you must have been pretty good. You must have auditioned well.
I took lessons from her for a year.
What'd you audition with?
Before. Oh, what did I audition with?
Yes. I shouldn't have asked that because I don't remember.
I had the Soar Variations on mm-hmm. the theme of Marlboro. Sounds a little bit like the bear went over the mountain. And what were my other audition pieces? Probably some Soar etudes,
yeah.
19th century stuff, and some Villa-Lobos etude.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I did, and then later I went back and did my doctorate there as well.
Yeah.
At Northwestern.
In Northwestern, I mean, I almost consider that's almost more of like a journalism school. It's a liberal arts school, right? I mean, they have a music theater program that's really big, too.
Yeah, they have a good music school. They have a school of music.
Yeah.
So it's different. University of Chicago has a department of music.
Is that the Beehive? Is that Northwestern?
Northwestern is the Beehive,
the
yes.
Right.
That's where I took flute lessons when I was 10, in the Beehive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but now they have a brand new swanky building that's uh-huh. right on the lake that just was finished a couple of years ago.
Oh, and it looks out to the lake? You can mm-hmm. like practice and look at the lake?
Yeah.
No, the practice rooms are always put in like, you know, the innermost recesses and bowels of any building. They're just like, yeah, they'll be fine. Put them there for 2 hours.
But it's a great school. They have a big program. And one of the things that was good about going to Northwestern is I could do jazz and classical.
Yeah.
So when I did my master's degree, I got to play in the big band, jazz guitar, and then also do all my performance classes with the classical guitar studio.
Oh, you were able to do the performance class. So the performance classes were mixed in.
Yeah. I got to take jazz and classical.
Oh, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice, well-rounded education there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as far as the classical, I mean, what did you guys focus on a lot of? Did you guys just focus on repertoire or some technique? I mean, because at that point, you probably were doing a lot of technical work just to get your right hand and, you know, working correctly and stuff like that after not doing it.
Oh, sure. And there was a big emphasis also on pedagogy. So that...
On teaching?
Mm-hmm.
On new teaching?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So we got to do practice teaching and study different... methods of teaching, and I got started very early in my own classical guitar studies, also teaching.
So you started teaching right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the science and stuff like that, I mean, I'm kind of blown away because you did musicology, which is a science, isn't that that's a science degree?
It was a BA.
So it's a Bachelor
of Arts. Yeah, humanities degree.
What do you study when you get a musicology degree? What do you do? I think somebody else was in here talking about it, but I've already forgotten.
Oh. Well, at the undergrad level, we had the basic music theory classes uh-huh. that we did and music history.
Right.
And U of C had a very strong ethnomusicologist there, Philip Bowman.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a fair amount of ethnomusicology and anthropology.
Amazing.
So learning how to think and write about music.
In its relationship to social mm-hmm. social things.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely. Politics, history.
Politics. Oh, do you remember anything like interesting politically that happened?
Oh, sure.
I mean, obviously.
No,
yeah.
I have so
like,
many
like, there's the
fun...
Medicis and there's, you know, Elizabethan stuff, mm-hmm. I guess. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. I'm really glad I did that.
Or did you
I
go
did
even
that.
Further back?
Oh, with...
I guess
with
that's
music,
media, yeah.
Music history?
Yeah.
Or musicology. Further back, I would say.
Yeah.
Definitely. And in doing the doctorate, basically at the end of the studies, one of the exams we had was to be given a piece of notated music without in any indication of the name of the piece or who wrote it.
Yeah.
And then we had to examine it and write a convincing essay about who we thought wrote it and what type of music it was, and show what we saw in the score.
Right.
That made us think it was written by that person.
That was the test.
Yeah.
So and you had to know three the players different ones.
Yeah. So it was really fun to do tons of score study to get ready for that, to look at what music looks like from different time periods.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun. I like studying not just guitar music, but
you like studying. It sounds like you're a good student. It sounds like you're a good student.
Sure. Yeah, it never ends. Studying never ends.
It never ends. And as far as what happened after that, you said you took 7 years off to go into some research, essentially,
right.
as a mm-hmm. research assistant, I'm going to assume, or something along those lines.
I did. Yeah, I was a research assistant on a neuropsychiatric study.
Yes.
And on dementia for a year.
On dementia?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I would administer the exams, but then after that, I was the project coordinator for a couple different studies.
Yeah.
Doing the data collection. I think data collection is really cool, getting information from people and really valuing their lives in
right.
a way that you can share what they've lived through and help others and learn about life experience through the experience of people.
So you sharing. Would actually conduct interviews?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty cool. And was that like just were you dealing with like what kind of groups were you dealing with?
One study was a natural history study of the HIV virus, AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
So people would come in who were in the study every 6 months and undergo a set of questions. And we were at that time in the 80s still not sure what the progression was, and there weren't a lot of drugs yet. So we were tracking the illness. And after that, I worked on a study for 3 years looking at people who had a mental illness that were going back to re-enter the workforce after having to leave because of their mental illness. So it was a study of vocational rehabilitation, helping people get back into school and get training and get jobs. So I worked on some pretty serious issues for those years.
Yeah, that must be rewarding as well. And your perspective is shifted genuinely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you get to touch the periphery of humanity and life.
Right.
And see how special every single day is and the capacities that we have, of how lucky we are when we have them.
When we have health and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I learned a lot about people, and that gave me a lot of courage to go to music school.
Right. Yeah. To go to music school. But as far as going to music school, it sounds like you were kind of pulled in two different directions. Like you said, science and music.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you tried to reconcile them for the first half. And then for the second half, you're like, I think music is about playing music. So you decided to play some music.
I did. I thought about getting a degree in music therapy, but I wanted very much to get a very rigorous performance education and
right.
to get that experience. But right. now I feel like my life is coming around full circle. So I've spent that time doing research and working in the realm of public health. And then I spent a lot of time in music performance and teaching. But now what I'm doing is I'm crafting a lot of my teaching to help people gain more well-being and health through music study.
Yeah.
So that's my next adventure. So
well-being and health through music study.
Yeah. Not from sing-alongs or things that you might associate with music therapy, or at least the things I observed when
Doing yeah, because I have never really had any exposure to that. But is that what it was? It was sing-along?
Oh, some...
That's what music therapy is?
Oh, it's so many different things. It's meeting people's needs through music. But when I was first looking at it, I went to some nursing homes mm-hmm. and saw the music therapists coming in and leading some sing-alongs. And I wanted to...
With multiple people or just with one person at a time?
Yeah, with the big group.
Oh, okay, cool.
So, but what I want to do is teach people how to play the guitar and offer them the gains that we get in our lives from serious music study and help them with whatever they're going through, whether it's a veteran coming back from having fought in the war and dealing with PTSD or sleep disorder, or very young children or older adults. And I'm going to use the study of music as a way to help people.
Yeah, what do you think we get out of that? I mean, like you're saying, there are certain things. I mean, I can't pinpoint exactly what I get out of it because I'm a professional musician and teacher, but I don't know exactly. You know, people often talk about that, especially people that don't play a lot of music, talk about the advantages of learning an instrument and stuff like that. And there's that TED Talk video. I don't know if you saw it. Did you see the TED Talk video? There's a TED Talk video that I saw recently that has that explains why we're smarter than other people.
Oh, musicians. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I've been to conferences.
It says, like, actual players, you know.
Yeah.
And note readers and stuff.
Oh, sure. I went to some music cognition conferences where psychologists who study music and the effects on the brain showed actual pictures of musicians' brains, comparing them to non-musicians' brains and showed the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I guess we get that out of it. But, I mean, there's also, like you're saying, for a rehabilitative purpose, it's not necessarily about making someone smarter. It's about making them, you know, more secure or confident.
I think so.
Or calming
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a guy down in Miami, the guy who went through that horrific face incident on the bridge. You know that guy?
I don't.
Okay, well, something happened to this guy, his face. It's a national disaster. You know, something happened to this guy. And, we, you know, me and my friend looked him up the other day, and apparently he's just, you know, he's had work done on it. But he's just, you know, by himself, the only interview he did, he was playing his guitar the whole time.
Mm.
Which is interesting.
Because mm-hmm.
he was a homeless man.
Hmm.
But now he's, like, playing guitar. So mm-hmm. I'm assuming that somebody got in there, and, like, it's part of his rehabilitation. You know, just, like, playing songs on it. And, I mean, and that's so, I mean, how do you think that kind of manifests? From a scientific standpoint, how does it work? Because for me, I've always done it, so I don't know what it feels like to not do it. I don't have the perspective of, like, being upset and playing guitar and feeling better.
You don't?
I mean, I don't have that often,
To miss a few days.
There are other things that I do.
Yeah.
Well, no, if I have to miss a few days of playing guitar, it starts to get on me. I start going, like, ugh. You know, it's like not working out or something, you know, something along those lines, because you're just not working that part of your brain. But I almost feel like there's a lot of things that we could get that out of, you know?
There's so many. Yeah, right. I mean, I certainly don't assume to even know all the ways that other people... I know, for me, how calming it is to practice rhythm and to play the drums. I also play the drums.
Mm-hmm.
And to work on something that's a long-term project, like learning repertoire, and having that time that I put in each day and not necessarily having that immediate result, but feeling locked into the process.
What kind of pieces are you playing now?
Oh, right now?
Did you play at the Manus Festival or did you just give workshops?
I was a clinician and I taught a workshop on rhythm,
right?
Time and rhythm. And I also coached a bunch of ensembles, which is mm-hmm. a big part of the festival.
Right.
The ensemble playing and people making music together. And then I taught a master class.
Right. Now, as far as the workshop, the rhythm workshop, what did that entail?
It entailed a lot of vocalizing and clapping and also doing some technical exercises.
But it was rhythm.
It was all focused on rhythm. Yeah, learning.
What was the goal?
The goal was to show people how they could become fluent in reading rhythms and very precise in playing rhythms. So I gave a lot of exercises that hopefully the students will take home with them and put into their daily practice routines so that they can be very precise about playing rhythms and have that be part of their toolbox.
Is there any sort of like, you know, just like underlying theory that you have about learning rhythm that you know, people may be missing out on?
Oh, well, the concepts that I gave are pretty simple, and one was to help people get past the analysis phase where they're looking at something that's notated and thinking, oh, a dotted half note, that equals 3/16th notes. And then by then that they've had those thoughts, that part of the score has already passed by a long time ago.
Right, for guitarists this is a huge issue.
So to start with that analysis phase of determining what a written rhythm means, but then after that, to spend a long time drilling that rhythm so that basically you memorize it.
Right.
And you look at it and you recognize it. You know what it sounds like because you've played it, you've heard it, and you're looking at something that you know. You don't have to look at it and try to figure it out. So I broke down a lot of the different rhythms into small units, and we played them together and did a bunch of games with them and made it fun.
Oh, so you, okay, so that's, yeah, you were making it fun.
Oh, yeah, we had a lot of fun. Yeah, it was great. Oh, I just loved the students at the New York Guitar Seminar.
Yeah.
They came from near and far, and the youngest was 10 years old, and they were high school kids and college kids and grad school students and adults and retirees. So it was a huge range, and everyone all working together and helping each other out. It was a very community kind of feeling. It was not competitive.
No, because there's no competition.
Yeah. But also,
which they talked about, and when I interviewed them, they talked about that. They were like, we don't want to introduce that element. We understand we can make money because people come to get that on their resumes and stuff like that. That's what drives a lot of people to these festivals. This festival doesn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were talking about the importance of the fact that Manus doesn't have that element in it and that it's more of an educational and communal sort of vibe. And that's what I like about it.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than like everybody, you know, upset and not really focusing on the master classes or the performances because they're worried about playing the next day.
And they don't have to think, well, how do I rank against the other people? So the
student, how do I fit into this whole scheme?
Yeah. It's nice.
Did you ever do any of that, competitions or anything like that?
I didn't do competitions. Mm-hmm. I've adjudicated a few competitions, and I've attended them. The GFA conferences.
Right.
Yeah.
But as far as what you're doing now, you are more or less a pedagogue, right? You are, is that the word for it?
I am, but I also do still perform.
What do you perform?
And I love collaborating with other people.
Yeah.
So I'm working on a project now with a singer named Bernard Holcomb. Mm-hmm. He's a tenor.
Yeah.
And he's based in New York. We've done a few projects together in the past. And there's also a 5-string violin player based in New York named Mass Swift. And so the three of us are going to be doing a project together in New York in the fall.
How did you guys all meet each other?
How did we meet?
Yeah.
Well, Bernard and I were both asked independently to perform a set of Libby Larson songs in Chicago.
Right.
So we were hired to do that, and so we learned the set of songs, the Rilke songs, and got to know each other in the process. And then we've done a few projects since then. He attended the Interlochen Arts Academy when he was in high school, and I taught there for a couple of years. So when I was there as a guitar faculty person, I did a faculty recital and brought Bernard back, and we did some art song, and then we also did some popular music and some George Gershwin, so a variety of styles, a couple of the Dominique Argento pieces, letters from composers.
Right.
And then Maz Swift I met through friends in California when she was out there performing. And there's a few other people in California that I'm working with as well. There's a viola player named Jen Karn, and we do some fiddle tunes, and we're mixing together some old-time banjo music with some some classical guitar elements and playing around with some mixing of genres. And there's a djembe player named Afia Walking Tree who I worked with years ago that I'm just now getting back in touch with and building a project with her as well. And she also does quite a lot of teaching, drum teaching.
Oh, okay, yeah. So you play drums too. Is that part of your educational process? Or, well, like as far as, well, I mean, as far as like you said, you were in Interlochen. First of all, what are you doing in California so much? What's with the split between Chicago and California?
Oh, I went out there in January to a festival and competition that David Tannenbaum was hosting at the San Francisco Conservatory. Mm-hmm. And Clarice Assad was having her guitar concerto premiered by Mark Teichholz.
Yeah.
And I went out because I wanted to hear it and attend the festival. And so for some reason, there was just a lot of great things going on in January and a lot of great networking. And then some projects that got sparked that I've been following up on.
Projects that got sparked for you?
Oh, yeah. People that I was meeting.
Just meeting in a festival. What did you guys say? I mean, that's amazing.
Oh, that just happens. That's also, it's the same way that I'm working on this project to teach veterans. It's because I met this neuroscientist named Rachel Markwald at a party in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And we got to talking, and then by the end of the party, we were already planning this project. So I think if you just pay attention and you're interested in what other people are doing, all sorts of projects emerge.
And that's a big thing with you, the projects. I mean, listen, you go on about it. It's a lot. It's a lot more than most people do. Most people have one or two at a time. You've got, like, it sounds like seven or eight.
It's like having a garden.
Well, how do you keep it? How do you keep it all going? How do you do it all?
Oh.
I mean, are you really?
I do have an organization coach. Yeah.
You
named
do?
Denslow Brown. Yep. She's my organization coach. And I've been.
What made you get her?
Oh, I've worked with her over the years for quite a few years, maybe 10 years.
Is that like sociology or whatever? That sociological research or whatever got?
No. I just accidentally walked into a workshop she was giving years ago and then followed up with her. And at the time when I met her, I was in grad school and running my own guitar studio in Chicago. So I was self-employed and also as a grad student needing to do a lot of things on my own. So it helped to have a person that I could talk to a couple times a month and say out loud what my goals were, and then check back in a week or two.
Yeah, because okay. You have to report to somebody. You're responsible for something as simple as getting these things done.
Sure, and it was a way of being
self-accountable. That's a big problem with us. Because a big problem with the self-employed musician, it's huge. Big problem is not having any oversight, not having anybody that you really need to answer to other than maybe like, you know, if you're dating someone, a spouse, like, what'd you do today? You know?
Right. But if like that. But
but if you don't have that going on, like I don't all the time, it's like, well, there's sometimes I can go an entire day and I don't have anybody to, you know, answer to. And I haven't done anything. It doesn't happen a lot, but it can, you know. Almost happened today, but man.
Oh, but it's hard to be accountable to yourself.
Yeah, sure
it
is.
We all have to learn that, especially as solo artists.
Uh-huh.
When I was first studying classical guitar seriously, I found that if I was hanging out with my friends and I said, oh, I have to go practice, that people would say, oh, no, you don't. Oh, come on, stay here.
You know? So you got to go to work. They're like, oh, go.
Exactly. Yeah. But if I said I have to go to a rehearsal, they would encourage me to go.
Because accountability.
Yeah, socially we're trained that if it's with someone else, then it's more important. But if it's work we're doing by ourselves, I don't think socially we're taught to value that.
No, I don't even value it in other people. And I myself have to do it. There's someone today who I'm supposed to meet And they said to me, hey, I'm going to practice and be a little bit later than we said. Is that okay? And I was like, yeah, sure. Meanwhile, of course, I should, of all people, I should understand that. But there was something in me that went like, well, this is important. You know, what do you, you don't need to practice. We have something important to talk about, which is stupid. That's ridiculous. That's, I mean, even me, who does practice every day, I have a problem with other people practicing instead of hanging out with me.
I think, well...
and addressing my social needs.
Yeah. But then when you have a lot of friends who are serious artists, that know what is required, it's not just a fantasy. They know what they want to do, and they're willing to do the work to get there.
Right.
And the work isn't necessarily punching the time clock at a job where someone else is paying them, but the work is their practice and their preparation. When you see them, I guess that's what taught me, because I had friends that were very serious dancers, and then another friend who was a very serious painter. And he just explained the etiquette about knocking on his door, because he could be in the middle of working on a painting.
Right.
So even though he only lived two doors down from me, I never just showed up at his place, because he could be in the middle of working on something. So I would always leave a message and make a plan. And I think that kind of respect of his time and his artistic process helped me to have that for myself.
Yeah, definitely. That artistic process, the idea of not being interrupted every 5 seconds, which is what happens.
Yeah.
Nowadays. Emails and texts, that's what happens, Stevie.
Right, and everybody.
Literally, like, I certainly can't get through a 10-minute period without something coming through.
Well, so
on the computer.
What I do.
So what's the organization? Yeah, go
if
ahead.
I work on, and some of these things I just made up, I didn't necessarily get them from my organization coach, who's wonderful. Her name's Denslow Brown, and she basically would help me think through what were the obstacles in a given week and encourage me to come up with my own strategies. So one strategy I have, if it has to do with the computer or the phone, I just turn it off while I'm working. But what interrupts me more than that are my own thoughts.
Okay.
Ideas popping into my head or worries. So I always have a notepad next to me when I'm practicing. And if something comes into my mind, oh, wait, I forgot to do this, or I have to call this person, or I have to buy that, I just write it on my notepad so that I don't even get up. Because if I get up, and I might get involved in some other kind of activity.
Which, so yeah, I write go it to down. The refrigerator or something.
Yeah. And then if it's a really big worry, especially something I can't do anything about today, I write it on a little note card.
Right.
And then I put it in a little special box so that I acknowledge it. Like, yes, here's my worry.
Oh, you have a special box.
Yeah. Or sometimes I'll move it to another part of the house because I imagine that I'm attending to it and caring a lot about it. So it's not that I try to push it away.
Yeah.
But I'll say, as soon as I'm done with what I'm working on now, I'm going to come back to you.
Yeah.
It really helps. It helps a lot.
So it's all about what you're talking about right now. You're talking about organizing your thoughts into physical little things, like pieces of paper, putting them into other physical things, like making them, instead of having them in your head, that's why people write down, like, if I get up in the middle of the night, if I'm having like a big problem, like I'm mad at something or I'm upset about something, I usually get up, write about it, and then that gets me back to sleep. Like, I get up, I write an email I'm not going to send.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, is that normal? That's kind of what you're saying.
That's great.
Just what do you call it? Materializing these thoughts. And then that it demystifies them. It goes like, oh, that's all that is. That's just, I just need to email that person. That's all that is.
It's good you don't send the email.
I don't send.
That's
angry.
Really smart.
I completely stopped sending angry emails about 5 years ago.
That's really good.
The biggest fights in my life. The biggest fights in my life, professionally or personally, have been...
3 a.m. emails
no.
that shouldn't have been sent.
No sending, no mean emails ever, ever. Have you ever made that mistake? Yes.
Not if I did. It's not been for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I did. Yeah. Not like super angry, but just, well, there was one that was super angry. There was one that was pretty angry. But no, never again. I try not to work from anger anyway, just to, as a beginner. You know what I mean? Because you ever hear that anger is maybe just sadness? It's sadness inverted or whatever. You heard that, right? I believe in that. I believe in that. If I'm angry about something and I go, you're just sad. And this makes you feel better about being sad because you maintain that energy. You maintain that focus. But you're actually just really just sad about something. Someone made you sad, you know, and it's easier to deal with if you're angry. So I don't know. I try not to get angry anymore. I haven't been angry for a while, I guess.
It's nice to find out what's underneath anything, really, because then you could say, and what's underneath the sadness? And there could be more something anger. Else under that.
Anger, sadness, anger, sadness. Like a layer cake of anger and sadness. And with that, we'll move on to education.
Yeah, it could be fear. Could
fear. Fear. Oh, dude, fear is huge.
Yeah.
Fear is huge. Yeah, you know what? That's something that I deal with, too, is I just go like, oh, I'm like really afraid of what this means. You know? Because every day when you do something, you take a chance. And I don't know. That's what I think. But you know all about this. You're like a psychology, sociology person.
Oh. Well, I don't feel like
you need to help me.
Know all this stuff.
Yeah.
But I know that learning music is incredible.
Learning music does that.
I know you were asking me in the beginning what are the things you get from studying music.
Yeah.
And I know that it's transformative.
Yeah.
That it's an opportunity to transform how you feel about yourself, how you connect to other people and even to humanity. And you can time travel. You can go to different historical periods. Yeah. And it's incredible the kind of agency that a person can feel.
Right. Agency is important. Yeah.
Learning and mastering something. And the process of attaining mastery is a beautiful process that's not easy. But when you stick with it and you don't give up, you can learn so many great things about yourself.
Yes. That's what I've always said about what my goal was when I was young. When I was 18, I said my goal is to master something before I die. Not to make money, but to master something before I die. Because I have seen people that have not done that. And regardless of how much money they make, they are upset about the fact that they really can't do a thing better than most people. You know? And that's a cool thing. Is that one of the things that maybe drove you to actually get a guitar performance master's?
No. The thing that really put me over was playing an extremely well-made classical guitar.
Oh, wow.
And
what guitar was that?
It was built by Richard Schneider, and he was a family friend. So he was always like an uncle to me. Yeah. So when he would come to visit, he would always bring his latest guitar that he had just built.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was taking some lessons with Ann Waller, and he was in town, and he showed me his latest guitar. And I was playing some Brouwer etudes on it, and it was so resonant, and it was so responsive to my musical ideas that I felt like I was holding a child in my arms, a living, breathing being.
Yeah.
And it was so moving to me that that's what made me want to take my playing to the next level. Visceral experience of playing that really well-made instrument and that feeling of expressing myself through the instrument.
That's interesting. I've never heard that before. I've never heard of somebody being driven to the instrument through the instrument itself. And I think that's something that happens to people that approach it later on. Because that's certainly, I think, for me, and it wasn't a well-made instrument. It was just a nylon string guitar. It was a Yamaha. And just hearing that for the first time at my high school girlfriend's house, just playing that. She didn't play classical, but playing around on that and being like, oh, listen to that. Listen to that warmth. You know, that's, so the instrument itself.
Mm-hmm.
The classical guitar.
Yeah, the instrument. I mean, you feel it. You're holding it in your lap. It's up against your chest. Mm-hmm. The vibrations are literally going right into your body.
Yeah.
Your right arm is touching it, and your left fingers are on the strings, and all the vibrations are going right into your bones.
Yeah.
And so you just feel like, I feel like it's a part of me, the instrument itself, but also the music itself.
Right.
Yeah, it's really powerful, and it drew me into it.
All this stuff we take for granted, you know, or at least I do sometimes. But that's true. That is true. It's cradling a baby in your arms. And as far as babies, what about the teaching? Now, you have been driven to teach. You teach a lot. You teach about teaching.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And
you said you were at Interlochen. Was that your first big gig?
No, I think of my first big gig being the school I had in Chicago. Because I had that for almost 19 years.
Oh, my God.
Okay. And I was in a storefront, and it was part of a neighborhood on the north side of Chicago. And I was...
What's the north side of Chicago like?
What's it like?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know my Chicago stuff.
Oh, it's very diverse.
Diverse, okay.
Where I was. And I happened to be in a neighborhood called Andersonville that when I first opened my business, mm-hmm. it had the largest number of women-owned businesses in the city.
Ah.
So that was fun. I had a lot of peers, and there was a lot of creative energy and people doing their own thing. So that was fun. But then I was curious to teach in a school that had a faculty and recital hall and auditorium and lots of resources. And that was something that was fun about the Interlochen teaching and the students coming from different countries. Yeah. I enjoyed that a lot. And then right now I'm really enjoying the traveling that I'm doing. So basically I'm selecting some different locations around the world where I have some projects that I come back to on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And one of them is in New York, one's in California, and another one is in Australia.
Oh.
Working
with... You get to go down there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, fun.
Have you been?
No, I never go anywhere.
Oh, it's amazing. It's really great. Yeah. The people, the nature, it's really great. And the people I met when I went last spring and visited Brisbane and Sydney, Adelaide, and Melbourne... They were all really enthusiastic and very interested in working together. So I'll be going back this spring as well to do some more teaching and playing and
hanging out with cool, the Aussies.
Yeah.
With cool Australians.
Yeah, they're very laid back, very passionate about what they do.
Well, it's a guitar center. You know what I mean? It's where half of... the guitars come from, it seems like.
Oh, yeah, there's some really good luthiers there. I haven't gotten to know them yet. I've known Richard Brunet for a long time
in
Evanston, and I definitely wouldn't be the player I am without him, because going to his shop and playing his instruments and the many, many instruments he gets from builders from all over the world and everything from Flatas to Hausers and... all through the history of guitar building, he lets the customers try out and play, and they've taught me so much about the instrument.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. Okay, that's different, because most shops are like, here you go. Don't play for too long.
Oh, no, he's amazing.
I'm going to be up here.
He's incredible. I can't believe he hasn't gotten an honorary doctorate from some school. He deserves at least one honorary doctorate. He's
Yeah, I think my friend brought a Redgate from him or something. Like
yeah,
that.
He's incredibly knowledgeable and very, very generous.
With his time.
Sharing his time, his enthusiasm, his knowledge, his encouragement, and letting you play his guitar his collection. Oh, right. Yeah.
And he's enthusiastic about his collection.
Yeah, I feel like I should list him as one of my teachers.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
And then here in New York...
I want to get a dealer on. I have a dealer that sponsored the show for 2 years, Richard Sage. He's amazing.
But, uh-huh.
You know, I want to get him on. I don't think he wants to come on.
Oh.
I think he's nervous.
Well, some
But he's like super sweet. So I'm like, oh, just I want to get somebody on.
Gary Lee would be a good person.
I've had Gary Lee.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've had Luthiers on.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, Dealer.
William
Kramer
Henderson, I just interviewed him too, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Dealer. Like a straight up Dealer. Like a Beverly out here or someone from like a Guitar Salon or something like that.
Hmm.
I got to have him on. That'd be great.
The other thing I've been doing recently is...
Because they meet everybody. They know everybody.
Oh, so they would have some good stories. Yeah, sorry, I'm not sharing any juicy stories.
Oh, you are sharing some. We don't need to talk about stories. We're having a good time. This is fine.
The one thing I got to do about a month ago that was just incredible, I was spending time with Randy Angela, and he's a guitar builder in Concord, California.
Yeah, that's where I'm from, Stockton.
Oh.
Yeah.
So he was letting me watch him in his final stages of assembling one of his new guitars and do the measurements for placing the bridge. And so I got to see the bridge being glued on, and it may seem really small to talk about it, but I felt like it was this incredibly powerful experience to see, here's the place where the vibration of the strings gets transferred into the soundboard.
Yeah.
And here's
the touch point.
Yeah. Yeah, right there. I felt like I was touching like the heart of the guitar.
Yeah.
And so I've recently become really interested in guitar building.
Oh, yeah.
Not that I would become a builder, but I just want to learn as much as
I can
about
it. Did you have Gary set your action for you, or did you do that?
No, apparently. I've
been out to his. I've been out to his place, not during the interview, but afterwards. I have a hand problem, and so for like when that happened, when I got this dystonia thing, I went and I was like, "Ooh, I know what I'll do with my life. I'll be a guitar." This is like 4 years ago. I'll be a guitar builder. So, not knowing, I was like, "Okay, so you cut the wood?" You know what I mean? And I mean, I knew there was more to it than that, but I was like, "Oh, maybe I can be an apprentice or something like that." So, I went into him. And he was, we spent like 8 hours just setting the action. Just, you know, figuring out the specific millimeters to the height of the nut and stuff like that. And I was like, I don't want to do this. This is too much stuff. But it was interesting. And I felt like, all right, that's, you know, check that off my list because that was cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Just setting the action on a brand new guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, working with the bone, smelling that smell of the bone getting shaved down. It's kind of gross, but it's kind of cool.
And other things that I was really interested in is the sound. So the little sounds that luthiers pay attention to. So, for example, Randy was figuring out how deep to make the grooves in the nut, and he would take a metal straight edge, and he would pull it through the nut, and then it would make a little tap sound on the first fret, and then he could tell from the pitch if the groove was deep enough. And that was really fun.
Oh, wow.
To witness. Yeah.
So they all have their own tricks, because that's not what Gary does.
Right.
He has like math. It's math.
Right.
Math there.
Yeah, I do think that the luthiers are different. I mean, they certainly calibrate and measure, but yeah, I think some of them do things more with feel, the tactile sensation.
Yeah, for sure.
And some do more measuring. And then this oral part of it was really, really fascinating to see.
What's
Randy
doing. They yell into the sound hole or something? Or
oh, yeah, that too. And the tapping the woods. Yeah. Just hear it. Yeah. It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful craft. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful craft. It's pretty amazing.
And to see all the care they put into things that don't necessarily need to be as beautiful as they are. Like the artistry of the colors and the woods being dyed. Yeah.
Inlay of the rosette. That's always blowing me away. I'm always, look at that rosette and I'm thinking, like, how much time did that take? But they do it. They do it. And they all have different marks.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. It's like a sword. It's cool.
Yeah, their print.
Yeah, right.
I wonder what my rosette would look like.
If
I was going to design one.
I know. That's the thing. Like, I mean, there's got to be a way we could do that. Yeah, I'm sure you could do a custom rosette. I don't think mine would have a recognizable face. It would be more like a pattern.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What, any special colors?
I like my rosette right now. It's like brown and red and black and blonde.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, I don't know. I'm pretty simple as far as that goes. As far as the teal and all that stuff like that, I think I don't think I would do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's my... Bright colors aren't my wheelhouse. What about you?
My current rosette, I play a 64 Velazquez.
Yeah.
And it's mainly brown and blonde and black.
And red.
or I don't have any red in it.
Yeah. Well, it's a Velazquez. Where'd you pick that up from, Australia?
No, my dad bought it in New York way back when.
In the 60s, 70s?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the 60s. So he was a jazz drummer, and then he also played clarinet and sax in the Air Force band.
Oh, wow.
And then he got interested in classical guitar because his younger sister was playing folk guitar. So he got interested in the guitar, and then he was studying at the Joe Fava School of Guitar in Detroit.
Sure.
Same teacher as Scott Tennant.
Yeah, that's why I had Scott on. He was talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's crazy. And as far as, like, you know, we were just talking about, we both know Isabella Abanizio,
mm-hmm.
right? And you were there. She's a neighbor of mine. You were just there
she
before.
She says hello, by the way.
We'll tell her hello. I'll tell her hello, too. But she is, you said you were discussing educating children on the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
What were you guys talking about? You guys were having a big meeting about it. Were you guys, like, sharing insights?
We were. Yeah, I was hoping to have a big debate with her. But we pretty much agreed on everything.
You're like, let's debate. Like, what would you debate? We're almost done. But you know, it seems like you're very passionate about this. At least when you came in, you were like, oh yeah, we're both very passionate about teaching children. And that's not something that all of us have. Like, I kind of come and go on that. I'm not necessarily passionate about my approach to teaching children. I'm just really good with kids. And I play guitar.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, my mom was a preschool director. I worked at a preschool for a year.
Oh.
When I took a year off from college, I you know, in high school, every summer I'd work at the preschool. Then after that, I immediately got into the Child Boom program down in Austin. And so I have a lot of background with kids. And I've been teaching kids for 15 years regularly. Is this something that I chose to do? I don't know. But, like, you know, you seem to have, like, a passion for the actual discipline and maybe the text or whatever. Like, what kind of text do you use? What kind of music do you give them? What's your initial approach to a beginner student?
I have little songs that I use, little songs that I learned when I was a kid, because my dad did teach me some basics on the instrument
right.
when I was 4 years old.
Yeah.
And so I remember how much I loved singing.
Yeah.
As a child.
Yeah.
So I teach a lot of songs, and we do a lot of games and strumming the open strings while singing.
Right.
And then doing songs that just have one chord in them and then going to two chords. So I use a lot of folk music. And I find that my interest in teaching kids ends up spilling into teaching all the ages, because there's a lot of things that are the same when you teach kids versus an older person. It's just that the slices are thinner for the kids. So if you're slicing a piece of cake,
that's exactly right.
The kids just get really little skinny slices, and then older
right.
would get a bigger slice, but it's still the same cake.
Yeah.
And I guess the debates, it's very curious to me about the order that things are taught.
Oh, okay.
I'm very fascinated by how things are presented. And I'm also curious about that artistically, too. I mean, from a compositional standpoint, what themes get introduced in the composition, at
right.
what point in the composition, and where do they get developed, and how, and in an opera, what information do you get right away about the characters,
right.
and what gets held till later, and what's a pretend secret about this character. I think the information you get and how you get it is really interesting.
Right.
On all levels, teaching and also in art itself.
In art and storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really, you can also think about teaching as storytelling.
Yeah. Ah. That's true. Yeah, I mean, you definitely have to have a passion for entertaining those kids a little bit, you know, because you got to keep them entertained.
Well,
because they're not getting a grade.
I don't think of it as entertained. I mm-hmm. think of it as being engaged.
Okay.
And yeah. so I just don't do things.
Much better word for it. Sure.
For a long time. Yeah. So we might do something for a minute.
45-minute lessons. I don't do that anymore. I do half-hour lessons.
Yeah, mm-hmm. for kids.
That hurts my pocketbook. You know, that makes it where, like, I could, you know, I could be like, oh, well, you know, they need a 45-minute lesson, an hour lesson. I double the amount of time that I'm teaching with the same amount of students, but I don't do that. They get a half an hour lesson.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
And also, when you teach kids, there's a lot involved with talking to the parents and helping yeah. them, because all parents really mean well, and they want to help their kids, but they don't necessarily know how.
Yeah, so how do you address that?
And sometimes the things they think they should be doing actually hurts the kids. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's true.
They might see me in the lesson giving some information, then they go home and maybe they want to correct their child over and over, but the kids usually feel a little beaten down by that.
Right,
it doesn't inspire them to keep playing.
Yeah.
So I, in the lessons, I teach the parents how they can support their kids and also have fun with it and enjoy it.
Oh, good.
So that music is a healthy part of their home. Yeah, and something that makes them feel like they're enjoying the time with each other, not fighting about things or feeling like, oh, it should be this, or you should be doing it that way or this way.
Well, I enjoyed my time with you, and I don't feel like I should be doing anything this way or that way.
Well, thanks.
So thank you so much for joining me, Jennifer. And
thank
is there
you,
anything
Brett.
Else you want to talk about before we go? Anything that you want to, you know, like a little promo for something you're doing in the fall or something?
Oh, a promo?
I don't know.
Well, I'll definitely be back.
You'll be back in New
York? In late October, early November.
Oh, I got to come see you.
Doing my projects with okay. Maz and Bernard.
Okay.
And I'll be in California working with Jen and Afia. And then I'll be putting together some of my workshops that I offer on rhythm and also learning different aspects of guitar
yeah.
playing
mm-hmm.
and teaching teachers, doing some teacher training.
Cool.
All that ultimately is going to be on my website.
Awesome. Okay, well, we're very excited to, you know, check that out. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thanks, Brett.
All right, guys, that does it for my time with Jennifer. We'll see you next time. Have a wonderful holiday season. Thanks for listening.